Chapter 11. Belief. The oyster catchers make their nest at the edge of the beach above the tide line of the highest tide, just where the shingle fringes into the grass. It is in the bank of pebbles in front of the house, and every time I come back from the boat, the birds are troubled. The sitting oyster catcher never leaves with hurry or alarm, just a slow, measured walk away as though wandering casually across the upper part of the beach. For such a heraldic and noisy creature, the discretion is extraordinary. Alarm at a nest would, I suppose, demonstrate something to be alarmed about. The nest itself, which I've marked with sticks, so that no visitor stands on the eggs, shares that cryptic genius. It is a shallow depression dished into the stones with an odd cousin relationship to my dug pool. The pale khaki eggs are speckled, so that the effect is of the beach itself flecked with its own shadows. Neither nest nor eggs have any smell. The dogs can walk and nose within inches of them and not realize they are there, and yet the birds have decorated their scoop with pieces of broken cockle and one or two old bleached periwinkles. In other places, oyster catchers quite consistently choose what they like for their decoration, some nothing but limpets, others striped land snails, but here the theme is a rudimentary scatter of white things. I wonder why? To distract from the eggs themselves? To conceal the eggs with the brightness of their surroundings? To make the important unseen? I am at the nest for a moment. The birds are anxiously away from it, and they begin to talk. In Gaelic, the oyster catcher is Bridin, the bird of St. Bridget, or of Brigid, the pre-Christian goddess of poetry and song, whose cult was fused with hers. And so now Brigid's song begins. Biglich, biglich, be wise, the oyster catchers are meant to say when a stranger comes near their haunts. But I wonder if that suggestion of sagacity is an old joke. At first, maybe they are like that, saying merely quick, quick, with the comma audible between the notes. Or as if this were a kind of hello, an interrogative, quick, quick. But soon enough the wisdom goes, the gaps shrink, the pace picks up, quick, quick, the liquid runs faster from the throat, and soon the cry rises to the point where there are no gaps at all, no understanding is in evidence, and all the birds are crying feverishly, quick, 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 ending at last with a long and assertive quick, which says, this is my place, this is my place, why are you here? The ever-desperate, high-pitched oyster catcher is also called the Trilljechan, a name which has the same elements as the word thrill in it, connected in the depths of Indo-European language structures to piercing and the ancient root of the word through. Unkindly, then, the oyster catcher might be thought of as the mind-penetrating screecher. There are 11 different oyster catcher species spread across the world, and they all pipe like this. The song itself, if that is not too complimentary a term, is innate, a shared and inherited habit, neither learned nor different in different places. Young oyster catchers raised alone and in private know how to screech as well as any other. The birdsong ecologists, Edward Miller and Alan Baker, have shown, by tracing the evolutionary relationships among oyster catchers and other near-related shorebirds, the stilts and avocets, that many of the sounds they make are of deep antiquity. They are not the oldest of living sounds still to be heard. Grasshoppers and crickets began chirring 230 million years ago, filling the air of the Permian moss forests. But piping, similar to the modern oyster catcher, as Miller and Baker have said, contributed to the biological soundscape more than 65 million years ago. These sounds would have been audible to most dinosaurs. Biglich, biglich, is as old as the basalt boulders on which the birds stand. Few cultures have been so attentive to the sounds of the natural world as the one that lived on this bay. Alexander Carmichael, the great Victorian folklorist and collector from Lismore, listened to one of his informants, Janet Campbell, a nurse from Loch Skipot in South Uist. She sang many beautiful songs and lullabies of the nursery, and many instructive sayings and fables of the animal world. These she sang and told in the most pleasing and natural manner, to the delight of her listeners. Birds and beasts, reptiles and insects, whales and fishes talked and acted through her in the most amusing manner and in the most idiomatic Gaelic. In what voices did Janet Campbell sing? Was she a cricket, or a slowworm, or a periwinkle, or a prawn, or a lesser rorqual, or a porpoise, or a shoal of herring, or a dab or plaice, or a frog, maybe? Did she imagine the voices of animals that could not actually be heard? All lost to time, but there is no doubt that the boundary-crossing habit of mind was alive here through the millennia. The natural world, seen by us now as something sufficient in itself, was for all the centuries this bay was fully inhabited, intimately continuous with human lives. Vocal affinities spread far beyond the oyster catchers, and all the evidence suggests that for the Gaelic world, the boundary was permeable between natural and cultural, animal and human. Listen, for example, to the West Coast Gaelic song of the courting frog, sung with passion to his hesitant frog-a-more, the burp, glottal, glug-glug-glug of the lovesick amphibian. A hiuvar, a hiuvar, an huinich lat, an vialeg beg, a huku egg, an tober goum, a gul e gul. My dear, just remember the little promise you gave me beside the well, my love, my love. Animals in traditional societies, as Claude Lévi-Strauss famously wrote, are chosen by people as totems, not because they are good to eat, but because they are good to think. In the pre-modern world, animals were understood as co-actors in the drama of existence. Usually Lévi-Strauss's phrase, bon à penser, is translated as good to think with, another way of using the animal as a tool in the human manipulation of the world, a set of metaphors and a vocabulary by which our minds can acquire and arrange our surroundings. More fruitfully and more sympathetically, bon à penser might be seen as more directly equivalent to bon à manger. Just as an animal can be delicious and good in the mouth, it can be delicious and good in the mind. They don't need to be part of our surroundings. They can exist for themselves, and that sheer co-presence of animals in our mental life is a source of well-being. When the singers of the Gaelic world become frogs or bees or whales, their vision acquires a contour beyond the demands of survival, competition or fear. There is more to this existence, in other words, than Malthus could ever dream of. Animals are good to think. Of course, animals can play out the powerful and difficult parts of human relations in a way that allows the scarcely sayable to be said. If a simpleton forgets the necessary realities, wanders gormlessly away from home, and a thief sneaks in, it does not take much to see those events as the story of an oyster catcher who is interested in many things and walks away without thought from his nest. When he comes back, he finds the eggs gone and, in great distress, cries out, peeping and squealing, Cogol na hoien, cogol na hoien. Cha huela mi riev a lieid, cha huela mi riev a lieid. Who drank the eggs? Who drank the eggs? I never heard the like, I never heard the like. A hoodie crow listened to the shrieking, his head turning now on this side and now on that, giving his bill some busy-looking wipes on the moss at his feet, looks up with much affected innocence, and calls out in deep and sympathetic tones, Chiacuella na shinye, shinye, heen shinye, Ged is shinye san adje. No, we have never heard of such a thing ourselves, though we have been here quite a bit longer than you. The metaphor does not collapse. The story remains a tale of the oyster catcher and the crow, just as much as of a naive youth and a lying, dark-coated reprobate. It may be a morality tale, using the birds to think with, but they are also clearly good to think. There is a mental tastiness about them, and the experience of the world broadens with the reality of other creatures made vivid within it. A mile or so west of the bay, according to the minister of Morven in 1845, an old respectable person rented both the inn at Loch Allen and the small foot ferry by which passengers paid to be rowed across the mouth of the Narrows there, a short water journey that saved a detour of 5 miles around the head of the loch. To entertain his guests, the innkeeper trained a magpie to talk. All went well, the bird amused the customers, and trade blossomed. The innkeeper would regularly ferry customers over from the other side. One day he heard the familiar call from the far shore, "Ferry, please! Ferry, please!" And so, as usual, patiently and laboriously, he went down to his boat and rowed over to the landing on the other side, where he found his docile pupil perched upon a rock, chuckling with heavy mirth at the success of her imitations. As the distance the ferryman had to row was about 300, usually windy, often tide-rippled yards, this story cannot be true, nor are its elements difficult to decipher. The voice of a magpie sounds like mocking laughter, and an old respectable person is, by definition, someone to be mocked. Nature will always taunt the stupidity of human self-importance. The magpie was the only bird that did not go into the ark with Noah and prefer to sit outside on the roof. He is the voice of otherness, suspected everywhere of wickedness and deceit. Witches, in both Mull and Morven, had become magpies in the past. Like other corvids, they are clever birds, can certainly learn to parrot human speech, and so the story admires them for that cleverness, at least in part. It also dramatizes the uncanny, making the strange ridiculous and so emasculating and accommodating it. The two stories are the same. The innkeeper is as stupid and vain as the oyster catcher, the magpie as canny and wicked as the crow. All these animals are both good to think and good to think with. There was no illusion in Gallic consciousness that human beings were alone in the world. The shoreline itself was said to be a place of sanctuary. The Black Shore, the Dŵr Chladach, was the name for the intertidal zone below the roll of seaweed thrown up by the tide, Rolach Rort, and above the sea itself. According to Highland belief, this half-place was an asylum from all kinds of supernatural beings that filled the night, fairies, ghosts, or evil spirits. Chiatig olch sembi on erche. It was said, evil comes not from the sea. But little here was ever given its true name. Evil comes not from the sea was merely a signal of the sea's implacability. According to his biographer, the abbot Athelnan, St. Columba, when he wanted to wreak vengeance on his enemies, prayed in the sea up to his knees till robber and blasphemer were drowned. The sea and its shore were part of a haunted landscape full of fears and projected anxieties. Our natural scepticism will put a barrier between us and the universe of fairy belief, which was general in the highlands and islands of Scotland until the early 19th century, and with residues of it lasting for 150 years more. But the world of fairies can provide one avenue into the mind of the past, which it would be vain to shut off. They were known as the still folk, the silently moving people, invisible and quiet, oddly like the presence of a virus in the air, except on those rare occasions when the gifted or haunted would see them as they were, as strange women and elf-like men, most of them only 4 feet tall, the women like little girls, often dressed in green. They were often called fisichen, meaning neutrally those that know, or in an effort to keep their power at bay, the good people, a sign that they were essentially bad. They could be anywhere, unseen, present with us now, as if they were our memories, often near to hand because they liked the haunts of men. They would hurt you and yours. You could know they had been with you or in your house only when something had gone or changed, or a person or animal had died or was diseased. They were the slinking, sneaking ones, with no more substance to them than an eddy in a cloud of dust as the wind blew across a yard. To call anyone by the name of the fairies was purely derogatory. This part of the world was full of them, and just as human ecology was open to the world of the animals at one end, there was scarcely a boundary between people and fairies. Strontian, just north of Morven on Loch Sunart, was Sron Un Chin, the promontory or nose of the fairy mound. Bein Iadin, the tall and elegant hill in the centre of Morven, carpeted in summer with rare lime-loving alpines, was one of their strongholds. How to find any access to this all-significant but remote mental world? It becomes more intelligible and more connected to the reality of life here if its stories are read backwards. These Gallic fairies are not the sweet little Tinkerbells of Peter Pan, but frightening creatures, somehow related to the ghosts of the dead, perhaps to an earlier forgotten set of gods, but coexisting in our world as present as ourselves, a third dimension of life alongside the human and the natural. Often their stories end in damage or disappearance, a man unexpectedly dying, a boy injured when his mother is away, a child or old woman turning strange and disturbed, disconnected from those around them, old or troubled people who had become lost or seem to have lost their selves. These are the phenomena we know every day as depression or dementia or kidnap or injury or murder. If you begin with those outcomes and substitute for the causes we turn to, the defects of age, genetic impairment, or the reality of domestic or sexual abuse and neglect, another set of explanations that rely on the sense that the dead may not be dead and that there are spirits alive in the world, the fairy stories become understandable. They are an explanation of the damage and grief implicit in a hard and demanding life. As such, they perform a service to well-being. People suffer and go mad, are hurt and lost, are undernourished and shrink from deprivations, are deformed, toothless, horribly thin, endlessly hungry, or unable to suckle their demanding, unthriving child. And none of this is the fault of any human being, but the work of the silent, slippery ones. In their thieving, they take away the substance of animals, crops, and people, but not their outward form. If it looks, for example, as if a stand of oats has been emptied of its goodness, or a cow quite inexplicably sickens and weakens, or a child is born odd or fails to do well, what the people are left with is not what they knew, but a fairy changeling, something that resembles the original, but which has none of the original goodness in it. Women in childbirth were especially vulnerable because fairy mothers found it difficult to suckle their own children. Instead of the mother, it was said, they would leave a lump of wood. Instead of the child, an old mannequin. The mother and child, it would be said, after the trauma of childbirth and its aftermath, would have been taken out of themselves and were now away with the fairies. Explanation is a form of comfort, and at least with the fairies, strange as they are, it was possible to imagine something of the structure of reality. They were not a source of delight or magic, but the accommodation of grief, oddity, and, as the great Gallic scholar Ronald Black has written, of crime. Fairies provided a code for the forms of behaviour society does not want to face. Crimes which socially and psychologically it would have been difficult to confront in a world without police or social services are spoken of through a symbolic language, which makes them acceptable or at least allows life to continue past them. Dr. Black quotes the Irish writer Angela Bourke. This is not to say that such explanations would normally be accepted or taken literally. Fairy legend charts the territory of no man's land. It comes with an air of the preposterous, the nod and wink, that allows one thing to be said while another is meant. It permits face-saving lies to be told and disturbing narratives to be safely detoured into fiction. The double meaning is allowed to persist, its doubleness retained, not collapsed into guilt or rage or retribution or even grief, all of which might be psychologically or socially intolerable. The shore played its part. In 1862, Arthur Mitchell, Deputy Commissioner for Lunacy in Scotland, reported from Mialista on the west coast of Lewis that he had seen an emaciated, shrivelled, helpless idiot, a dwarf with that puzzling expression of face, a compound of senility and babyhood. It was a distant part of the world where a man called Wild Murdoch had been suffering from episodes of mania. Murdoch's friends used to tie a rope around his body, make it fast to the stern of the boat, and then pull out to sea, taking the wretched man in tow. It would not have been safe, they said, to have him in the boat. He was so buoyant he didn't drown, but the idiot dwarf was not so lucky. He is believed to be a changeling of the fairies, who are supposed to steal away the human child and leave for it one of their own young old children to be nursed. The only remedy for this, of which I heard, is to place the changeling on the beach by the waterside when the tide is out and pay no attention to its screams. The fairies, rather than suffer their own to be drowned by the rising waters, spirit it away and restore the child they had stolen. The sign that this has been done is the cessation of the child's crying. It was a widespread practice. John Sands, a travel writer visiting Tiree in 1881, heard from the minister, the great folklorist J.G. Campbell, that 5 years ago a woman left her child, which she supposed to be a changeling, upon the shore that it might be taken away by the fairies and her own infant restored. No account is given of the true outcome of these exchanges, but the phrases are telling. Pay no attention to its screams, the cessation of the child's crying, taken away. All are transparent code for the murder of mentally damaged children whose continuing presence was neither helpful nor endurable. In families with no birth control, where women regularly bore 8 children or more, the idea that the mother might have her own infant restored is indistinguishable from fall pregnant again. Her own infant would return as another child. It is likely enough that over the centuries, this shore witnessed such scenes. Unbaptized children were buried in the shores of the Sound of Mull. People who killed themselves were usually buried even further down at the lowest of the tides. Arthur Mitchell found that if a suicide's relatives tried to avoid this terrible fate and secretly buried the body in a graveyard, the neighbours would dig it up, take it to the beach on the ebb, and bury it there. In the winter of 1822, he heard a poor old woman, in a fit of melancholia, cut her throat. She was buried at low water mark, but the sea disturbed her grave, and her body floated and was washed ashore. It was found there, and not being at first recognised, the people proceeded to carry it to a neighbouring house. When, on their way, the gash in the throat was observed, the body recognised and instantly dropped. For 2 days it lay at the roadside on the snow, till a person of influence in the neighbourhood had it buried a second time, and more securely, in the same fashion as at first. What is the lowest of low water marks, but the one place in the ground which is least like a place on earth? It is the place of placelessness. The taboo on suicide is so powerful that the body of the self-murderer, like the changeling, cannot be allowed a secure resting place in the known and human world. The act of suicide, like the theft of the person's being by the fairies, has removed these people from the known or the tolerable. They must be given to the sea, to be absorbed by it, to mark their final and terminal exclusion from humanity. In story after story, the weed marking the sea edge is the realm of trouble. In February 1623, on Oronsay, the tidal island lying off Colonsay, out to the west of here, besieged by Atlantic storms, the prior of the ancient monastery lay dying. He called for his kinsman, the last chief of the Colonsay MacPhees, to visit him. In the distant past, this had been MacDonald territory, and Col Ciardach MacDonald, known as Col Kitto, a pirate and seaborne gangster operating for years in these western seas, was attempting to reclaim his ancient lands. Col Kitto landed on Oronsay, his men armed with bows, dirks, two-handed swords, muskets and pistols. The tide was up, and as the MacPhee chief arrived to see his cousin, the MacDonalds killed two of his men. The chief himself escaped, running to the southern tip of Oronsay. At the shore there, he flung himself into the sea and swam from skerry to skerry across the reefs, about 800 yards to the low, rocky island of Elan Nan Ron, the island of the seals, and there spent the last brutal winter's night of his life. The next day, Col Kitto came out to the little island with his men. They knew MacPhee was there, but could see nothing of him. After a long search, they found him. He had buried himself under the bolt of seaweed lying at the top of the Atlantic-facing beaches. There is nothing but ocean between here and Newfoundland, 2,000 miles to the west. They tied him to a stone and killed him before, famously, digging the musket balls out of his flesh because lead was short. Col Kitto then took possession of MacPhee's lands. On an open skerry without trees, the bank of seaweed was the only place in which the sodden, frozen and terrified man could have found hiding. But there is surely more to this. The Gaelic term for his night-time's covering is rolag rod, meaning the roll of seaweed. The word at the heart of that phrase, rod, can never be used for weed still growing in the sea. It comes into play only when the weed is cast ashore, where it can also mean foam, or more exactly, the foaming sea that beats against the land. In this emblematic universe, the rod is the tangible form of the sea itself. It remains dynamic, not a pile of rotten weed, but the element of wildness cast up onto the land. Just as the suicide's grave is at the lowest point to which the ebb drops, the rod is at the highest point to which the sea comes. Those who hide in it are, in effect, hiding in the sea, or at least that part of the sea which is frothed and foamed up beyond the edge of the tide. All the potency of a transitional zone gathers in it, a place of safety and a place of threat, and on the mythic level at which these stories operate, MacPhee had attempted to hide himself in a realm beyond reach. The rod retained its power to frighten. In the early 19th century, on the coast at Drumabin near Fort William, a great shore searcher after storms was often found wandering, ghost-like in the grey dawn by the margin of the sea, diligently picking up every conceivable article of flotsam and jetsam that came in his way. Everything he found he kept, even if he suspected the gear belonged to his neighbours. A man who thought his goods had been taken decided one morning to give him a fright. The neighbour lay down at length on the shingle and covered his head and body down to his ankles with the driftware that had been cast up by the storm. All he left exposed was his feet and its pair of good, substantial new shoes. Meanwhile, the wrecker was advancing along the beach, carefully searching about and stooping from time to time, oyster catcher or curlew-wise, in order to pick up such waifs and strays as he fancied worth the while. When he reached the man lying under the seaweed, he slowly removed the shoes, but then a smothered, sepulchral voice from under the seaware struck his ear. Gav ma chwarl, sofag brogan shin. Take my advice and leave these shoes alone. At the same time, he saw the mass of driftweed heaving and moving. dropping the shoes as if they had suddenly become each a mass of red-hot iron in his hand. He started off with a yell that frightened the seabirds all the way to Camas na Gaol. He ran for his life back home, never went shore-wandering again, and soon after sickened and died. The story itself hangs in the margins of The Mortal. The shore searcher is grey and ghost-like, the neighbour pretends to be a corpse, and the greedy man dies from the fright he has been given. It is a comic version of persistent terror, and has a cousin in a third story, from the coast, a Kingaerloch in Loch Linney, around the corner from the bay. Between here and there are the rough grounds of Garraf Slis, the steep and difficult ravined country with which Morven drops to its eastern shore, still now unoccupied for many miles, with no easy path through it, and the setting for some of the most ancient and inaccessible tales of giants fighting with enormous satanic bulls in battles that lasted all day. Near Kingaerloch, a boat was upset, and the two men in it were thrown into the water. One hung on and was saved. The other, who was a strong swimmer, set out for the land. He had forgotten to cut off his shoes, and as he came near the shore and to the mass of weed that was turning in the surf there, his feet were entangled in it, and he drowned. When, some time later, his brother came past the place where the body had been picked up, a figure joined him on the road, looking something like a billy-goat, murmuring to him in a voice he could scarcely hear or understand, warning those who did not take due care in life that they should mend their ways. The Rod would clutch at any man in shoes. Morven is full of such fairy tales. Occasionally the little people did good. At Liddesdale, a fairy helped a lonely man with his ploughing and reaping. To some, they brought bowls of meal or filled the meal chest so that whenever the woman of the house looked into it, the chest would be full, only one day for it to be unexpectedly bare. More often, they brought strangeness and unhappiness to people's lives. On Ben Iadain, a fairy attacked a bridegroom who was walking over to the woman he was about to marry at Bar, at the foot of the mountain, on Loch Tekis. She died before he got there. At Rahoy and at Kin Loch Allin, fairies substituted changelings for babies and nursing mothers. Above Knock, at Loch Allin, at the mouth of the safe harbour of the loch itself, they lived in the hill called Sian na Rabecha, the fairy house of storms, or, in another reading, the fairy house of noise and cursing. At Achabeg, a man was kidnapped by them overnight and could remember nothing the next morning of what he had done or where he had been. In many places, little fairy women came to the houses dressed in green, often sitting down to eat, and often taking more than their share, a consistently terrifying presence, and never to be followed out of the house when they left. Fairies took away cows in the night to milk them, leaving them dry or with milk that had no substance in it, so the people could make no butter and have no cream. The fairies' own habitations were usually out in the wild, in the margins of the high ground and in the rough, inaccessible woods and gullies of Garraf Slis on Loch Linney. There, a glashtig, not a fairy, but a little thin woman whose soul had been taken by them, strong, grey-skinned, with thick yellow hair and dressed in green, watched over the cattle in the wild corners. Like so many of these fairy stories, the glashtig, whose name means the grey one, the wraith-like one, can be understood as a version of a social truth. A simple woman, excluded from the mainstream, pushed quite literally to the edge of the inhabited world and considered odd and dangerous. She was often heard but rarely seen, her voice caught in the wind, her home a yew tree, the only other occupant of the hills a rough man called Yellow Dougal of the Cave. He was a thief by profession and wanted one day to row across Loch Linney to Lismore. The glashtig came and took an oar in his curragh. He had never known anyone, man or woman, to have pulled so hard. When at last they arrived on the Lismore beach, he looked round to see who it was that had rowed with such power. There was no one in the curragh with him. When she died, the Glashtig was buried alongside the unbaptized children in the boundaries of the sea, where the tides in the sound washed over her body. The sea floods in and out of these tales, always the setting for strangeness, for a magic not unlike Ariel's, flirting with the terrible, finding the marvellous. There is the story, first, of Donald Livingstone of Bonavulin on the Sound of Mull. He was a man who could charm cows, even from his own house, without seeing them. But the great moment in his life was in September 1746, when he was swimming home from Mull across the Sound with the news that all Morven had been waiting for. Bonnie Prince Charlie had at last escaped to France. Hairy Donald, as he was known, had been a hero at Culloden, and now he flung himself into the water. In mid-channel, he met a large shoal of herring, followed by a huge whale, blowing loudly and throwing up volumes of water high in the air. The whale terrified him, and he was wondering how he could escape if the whale were to swallow him. Would he be expelled from the stomach of the whale as Jonah had been? He survived, lived to be an old man, dying in his bed, aged 88. He never had an illness and never wore trousers, sitting at his door in the coldest weather, telling his stories with a kilt over his knees and a blue bonnet on his head, bright to the last. Those with magic in them were at home in the sea. Donald Cameron, much loved and called a fool by the Morven minister, went a step further than Donald Livingstone. On his submarine journeys, walking along the bottom of the sea from island to island, he visited the wrecks and conducted interviews with the fish he met along the way. One time he was coming home along the seafloor from Tiree. It was very stormy weather, and the walking was difficult, and the road long. I became very hungry at last, and looked out for some hospitable house where I could find rest and refreshment. I was fortunate enough to meet a turbot, an old acquaintance, who invited me, most kindly, to a marriage party, which was that day to be in his family. The marriage was between a daughter of his own and a well-to-do flounder. So I went with the decent fellow and entered a fine house of shells and tangle, most beautiful to look upon. The dinner came, and it was all one could wish. There was plenty, I assure you, to eat and drink, for the turbot had a large fishing bank almost to himself to ply his trade on, and he was too experienced to be cheated by the hook of any fisherman. He had also been very industrious, as indeed were all his family. So he had good means. But as we sat down to our feast, my mouth watering, and just as I had the bountiful board under my nose, who should come suddenly upon us with a rush but a tremendous cod, that was angry because the turbot's daughter had accepted a poor, thin, flat flounder instead of his own eldest son, a fine red rock cod. The savage, rude brute gave such a fillip with his tail against the table that it upset. And what happened, my dear, but that the turbot, with all the guests, flounders, skate, haddock and whiting, thinking, I suppose, that it was a sow of the ocean, a whale, rushed away in a fright. And I can tell you, calf of my heart, that when I myself saw the cod's big head and mouth and staring eyes, with his red gills going like a pair of fanners, and when I got a touch of his tail, I was glad to be off with the rest. So I took to my heels and escaped among the long tangle. Phew! What a race of hide-and-seek that was! Fortunately for me, I was near the point of Ardna Merkin, where I landed in safety and got to Donald McLaughlin's house wet and weary. Wasn't that an adventure? Barefooted Lachlan, as he was politely known, was the third of the great Morven swimmers. He lived for hours in the water and alarmed more than one boat's crew, who perceived a mysterious object, it might be the sea serpent, a mile or two from the shore, now appearing like a large seal and again causing the water to foam with gambols like those of a much larger animal. As they drew near, they saw with wonder what seemed to be the body of a human being floating on the surface of the water. With the greatest caution, an oar was slowly moved towards it, but just as the supposed dead body was touched, The eyes, hitherto shut, in order to keep up the intended deception, would suddenly open, and with a loud shout and laugh, Lachlan would attempt to seize the oar, to the terror and astonishment of those who were ignorant of his fancies. There are echoes in that of the terrifying fairy playing dead in the weed, and although the Morven minister, Norman MacLeod, tells it as an amusing tale, with the fearsomeness largely disabled by the middle of the 19th century, there is more to Lachlan's story than this. His japes in the middle of the sound were enacting something that was even then disappearing. He swam naked, and because it was inconvenient in a tidal sea always to return to the point of his departure, would often be seen walking along the Morven roads without a stitch of clothing on his tanned body. Barefooted Lachlan was itself a euphemism. Society at last rebelled against his judgment, the minister wrote, and Lachlan was sent to an asylum in the south. There, within a few days of his arrival, deprived of his long freedom among the winds and waves of ocean, he died. Many other tales lie washed up on these shores, of drowning witches, surf-riding sea monsters and potent sea goddesses, many of them to be found in their different versions all along the western seaboards of Britain and Ireland. None is more foundational, or tidal, than the Cailleach, an ancient goddess who among her many adventures wanted to bridge the Sound of Mull at Remore towards the northern western end of Morven. Before she reached the tide, the strap on her creel broke and she dropped her enormous load of stones in what is now recognised as a Bronze Age cairn, the Cairn na Cailleach. It is a beautiful, hidden and almost unnoticed place, covered in crumpled rugs of moss and English stone crop, looking out over a narrow stretch of the sound, with the height of Ben Mor on the horizon. She was one night on the sea with her sons. The night was dark and freezing, the cold pierced to the marrow. She told them to keep themselves warm. "We cannot," say they. "Bail the sea out and in," says she. "We cannot do that," say her children. "Take the bailing scoop and fill the boat and bail it out again." They did so and kept themselves warm till morning, till they got a chance to come on land. Only with a goddess does the tide come and go beside one's feet on the strakes of the hull and between the thwarts. When asked her age, after bearing 500 children to many fathers, the Cailleach said, "I have seen the seal-haunted rock of Skerryvore, which is now out in the midst of the sea, when it was a mountain surrounded by fields. I saw the ploughing of those fields, and the barley that grew upon them was sharp and juicy." She is the goddess of the tide and of time, of erosion and change, of the coming and going of things, of the ways of flux. All the stories now are as neglected as the sea tangle itself. Neither they nor the weed are needed for the fertility they might once have brought to life here. The goddesses and the fairies are pushed away into the inert category called folklore. Neither Lachlan's jokes nor Donald's sea walks, nor the other Donald's encounters with the herrings and the whale, can animate the lives or spirits of people now. A cultural world in which meaning could cross the tide line, and where the connections between sea and land, animal and human, human and fairy, were vivid and continuous, has gone. The word fairy has itself become both sweet and toxic, not the embodiment of a potent and unaccommodated spirit abroad in the world, but a sentimentalised sugar-drop version of it, not an enlargement of understanding, but a retreat from it. I now wonder if the haunting of the fairies differed, in any essential way, from the anxieties of the prawns, the winkles or the sandhoppers. All of them experience the ghosts of fear and pain, the imagined or reimagined realities of hurt once suffered and to be suffered again. Life is unsustainable without such wariness. It is one guarantee of survival, telling the organism to be careful in a hostile world. Both fairy and fear banish naivety and create a balance in the mental universe of a person or animal. Take advantage of the world, it says, and eat its fruits. but recognized the danger that lurks in strange places.